Comentate.
Oh, you are listening to Dave O'Neill on the debrief here, and it's my pleasure to introduce Bradford Oaks. Brad Oaks, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Say hello, Brad.
Hello.
Yes, there he is. And we've just done two gigs in Bright, which is mountain country. Mm. Yeah, and we're just coming out of a service station now. It's, yeah.
Feeling brightous.
Feeling brightous. It's like when we... when me and Brad go on tour, it's like that thing, The Trip, except without the posh restaurants. Just put in schnitzels and potato chips in the place.
Mm, and sometimes we'll just catch food by the side of the road.
Yeah.
Just a bit of roadkill.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Brad, we've got to tour out the two gigs we've just done.
Yeah.
So the first one was the... What was it? Alpine Hotel?
The Alpine Hotel, and it was rambunctious, Dave.
It was in the main bar of a hotel, which I, when I said yes to it, God, I said yes to this gig in May, and it's now August. I didn't realise it was a snow gig.
Yeah, I mean, you probably should know that there's snow in
August. And because Bright is at the bottom of Mount Hotham, is it? Mount Hotham and...
Oh, it's at the bottom of all those mountains. You know, like, it's... In Bright, you've got access to Mount Beauty, Mount...
Buffalo.
Hotham. You can get to Mount Buller from there and Mountain Falls Creek.
Because the thing about snow gigs is that they're just full of... I don't know, how would you describe the people? And we were at the bottom of the mountain.
Well, it's interesting that... The snow used to be the preserve of the rich.
Yeah, not anymore.
No, and it's just it's accessible to everyone now, providing you just willing to throw buckets of money into it. But in these service towns like Bright, which aren't up the mountain, aren't the ski resorts, the people who stay there are the ones who eschew the... paying the fabulous amounts to be on...
To stay on Hotham and stuff. Yeah. So they're the cheapskates, basically.
Well, they're not the have-nots, but the have-lessers.
Yeah, so have-lessers are a very good way of describing them.
And they are...
Because you got an enormous reaction. In fact, that's when the gig turned for you.
Yeah.
For the better, because you had to go on first, and it was just in a main bar of a hotel, and it was free to get in.
And playing pool.
Oh, there was
footy was on.
Eating was happening.
There was a witch trial. No, I made that up. But,
there was a sacrifice going on somewhere. Oh man.
Meals were being served.
Oh.
Some people knew we were there to do comedy. Other people thought it was when they recognised Dave. They thought it was a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, what are you doing here? You're a skier. No, I'm not a skier.
So not a skier.
Not a skier. No.
He's so not a skier, he doesn't even know it's ski season.
No, that's right.
And,
Well, when we grew up, skiing was just for the rich. My brother used to go, but he was into sort of... That was extreme sport, so they would save up their money, him and his mates.
Yeah.
But these days, it's obviously a bit cheaper. Or maybe people got more money these days.
Well, I think people got more money.
Because those guys sitting down the front with all the tattoos are young guys that look like a Blink-182 cover band.
Yeah,
they weren't that wealthy. But again, as you said...
Was one of them dead?
they were the have-lessers.
No, that was Linkin Park, wasn't it?
Linkin Park, yeah, one of them died. Blink-182 is still alive.
They were probably, tradies. You know?
They were tradies, yeah.
They got a few quid and they were sure... Hell bent on us sculling beers on stage, weren't they? Have a shoey.
And they want us to do a shoey.
A shoey.
Which is a relatively new phenomenon where they want you to drink out of their shoe.
And,
Now, I don't know. At 52 years of age, I wasn't keen on that. I'm not, nah.
No, I wouldn't drink out of my own shoe.
Let alone their shoe.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. Oh, God.
Shoey, do a shoey. Do it. Oh, God.
But, you know, I'm not about to, I'm not about to not scull a beer.
No, you sculled a beer and got a round of applause.
But, you know, as I said to the audience, it broke my heart that I've done stand-up comedy for 27 years. I I got a lot of trouble to try and think of cleverish jokes, Dave. And,
yeah.
I got a round of applause for sculling a beer that some guy may very well have dipped his penis in before he gave it.
Oh no.
Look, you got to realise that that's, unless you're one of those comedian stars, at some stage you've probably drunk penis flavoured beer.
Oh, really?
Really.
You know, but snow geeks, I've done a few in my many years. Not as many as you, but, and they've got a certain flavour to them, haven't they, snow geeks?
Yeah, but that's different, though, because in a snow geek, there's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome in that.
Yeah, they're all trapped together.
And also, too, that it's kind of, what's the word? It's a leveller because everybody is wearing puffy clothes.
Yeah.
Right, so a couple of stoutish plus size fellas like you and myself could pass for guys who've just got really big anoraks on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and even then, like in snow geeks, when you'll find that there's the same people. There's the guys who just go up there every year.
Yeah.
You know, there's the guys who work there and all day long just
And then they just get on the piss at night and then heckle the comics,
And then
there's families too that go now, a lot of families.
And the guys who work on the machinery, and they like to rough handle men and women onto chairlifts and stuff like that.
Yes. And then when I did a gig in the snow on Hotham, before I reached the mic, a guy yelled out, "Oh, a genuine celebrity," in a sarcastic tone. And he was in the ski patrol, or what are they called? Former cop. He was a former copper.
Yeah, up on call.
Yeah, and he's just like...
Ski patrol.
Yeah, they're like wankers, I think, in the snow world.
Oh, yeah, they're snow scouts.
Yeah, they're snow scouts. They're like a cross between a parking officer and a... I say all this, but I've never really been skiing, so, you know.
Well, I did it once, and, not for me.
Well, I did it... I went out with a girl from Brighton, and they were all skiers, of course.
Right.
So I reckon I was about 23, and I went out with her, and it was alarming seeing a five-year-old do something better than you, ski right past you as you're falling over.
Well, even when I was, like, a lot smaller than I am now, that's when I first skied, but, see, when you're hurtle, it's not a word people use that much. When you're hurtle, it's kind of implicit that you're out of control. You don't tend to hear people say, and I was hurtling along in control, you know.
Yeah, you just fall. Yeah. You're falling down a mountain.
I was just hurtling across the mountain, just taking out clumps of people wherever I went. I was just like an errant bowling ball.
Would have loved to have seen that.
Oh.
And then our second gig was, so we stayed in Bright overnight. We stayed at a luxurious retreat, alpine.
With you and your two single beds.
My two single beds. Just in case you picked up someone who didn't want to sleep with you.
Boom.
In the motel next door, which was okay, actually. It wasn't too bad.
Yours smelled a little bit like...
water damage.
Water damage.
Yeah.
Mine was fine. It was nice and warm.
It was warm.
And, Did
your heater come on intermittently? Like every...
Nah, just roared on through the night.
Oh, okay.
But I had three single beds in my room.
Jeez.
And I slept in all three of them.
Did you push them together?
No, I just thought, this one's too soft.
Oh, yeah.
Boom.
Goldilocks.
The last one was just right. Yeah.
And then we got up and did a gig at the Duck Drop for the Bright Football Club.
Yeah, the Mountain Men.
The Mountain Men.
Yeah.
Yeah, we like mountain women and men.
That blew up in their faces a little. we like mountain women. Yeah, but you're the mountain men, so I think you like mountain men too.
Yeah.
And of course, you never lose accusing any Australian male of being a homosexual.
No.
Even at a football club.
No, they relish that.
I shouldn't have used the word accuse there, but that's how they take it.
Oh, yeah, of course. And that was a lot Well, it was a lot more control than the night before, wasn't it? Than the pub, the pub
was,
night.
Yeah, they were delightful. You know,
they were lovely country folk.
A couple of screaming kids running around.
Yeah, they're sort of up the back.
There
was a very funny moment where a little toddler ran towards the stage, but there was no actual raised area.
It's a designated stage, Dave.
Yeah, it's like a space, and ran towards you and grabbed the balloon, and then you said, "Pop the balloon, someone."
Yeah,
which is funny.
I know. It was just brought out the cruel streak in me.
Yeah.
But also too, when I take aim at someone like that, that kid's gonna be fine. But I was trying to, actually land one on whatever parent let that child, thought that was okay that a kid could just run through the gig.
Yeah.
You know. Where else do you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
AC/DC concert.
I think so.
Oh, there goes Brian. We won't see him for 20 minutes.
And then I've never heard of this before. We've done reverse draws before, which is a thing at footy clubs where they have a cash prize of, say, $5,000. You buy a raffle ticket and then they pull your number out of the hat and it gets down to, like, five people still left with their numbers in the hat, and then one of them wins $5,000 eventually. So it's like a suspenseful thing. Gary's number's pulled out. Oh, no.
It's a bit like Big Brother for money.
Yeah, but they were doing something called a duck drop, where they were getting a local farmer to drop ducks, and I thought they were real ducks, but they were plastic ducks.
Yeah.
Out of a helicopter.
Onto an oval.
Yeah, and the one that got nearest to the pin.
Yeah.
Got the prize.
Yeah.
Which is quite bizarre.
It's quite convoluted, you know, and I would have loved to have been there at the process, at the meeting where somebody said, "What am I going to do?"
Yeah.
And we'll have a reverse draw. Let's not do it like last year. What would be a really convoluted way of coming up with the numbers? I know.
Yeah.
Bill, you've still got that helicopter? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy, so? Yeah.
Jimmy, you've still got 150 ducks, haven't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Plastic ones? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, what if we painted a number? I assume they put a number. I don't know.
Yeah, there's numbers on them. Because they have to put numbers on them. Because you get given a duck with a number, your number 53, and when 53 comes out of that helicopter and bounces on the ground, and it gets closest to the pin, the stake in the ground, they had a stake in the ground, you win. But the guy was saying the year before it was windy, and they got dropped near the cricket nets. Somewhere in the river, somewhere in the Ovens River.
Do you remember the Poo Lotto?
No.
Yeah, where you mark out 100 squares on an oval. And then you get a cow. And it's going to take a shit somewhere.
That's right.
And so
that's another footy club thing.
Yeah, and so then there's like hundreds of people on the sidelines trying to skitter a cow.
Ah, the gigs we do.
Yeah, so anyway, that's... I hope we get some footage of that. Dropping the ducks.
We will. Yeah. Don't worry, we will. For sure. We'll put it on Facebook and Twitter because it is quite intriguing. But so you started comedy what? You started before me.
I did.
And I've had no one on this podcast yet that started before me, I don't think.
Oh, well, there you go. You know, it's just
What year did you start?
1989.
Yeah, I started in 90, so...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just... bow down to your master.
And where was your first gig?
I started at La Joke.
That's upstairs, where I started. Yeah, same here.
Upstairs, same last here. From the last laugh.
Yeah.
And I went through on that measured system of, getting an allocated spot, time limit, sticking to it.
Yeah.
Given notes about what worked and what didn't, and learning to assess my gig, plus doing other gigs. You know, I think my... the next place I worked was the Gasometer Hotel.
I never did the Gasometer. That's interesting. That hotel is that's a hotel in Collingwood.
Collingwood,
It's had a resurgence. It's got bands there.
Yeah, and I did a comedy competition there. And at the time, I was working at Melbourne University until my comedy career kicked in.
Sure.
I was working at Melbourne University as a temporary secretary and... word processor, because I had learnt word processing. This is back in the
Yeah, back
early 90s, but yeah. There weren't a lot of blokes who knew word processing.
No.
And I was working in the psych department, and I said to one of the sports psychs, I'm in this competition tonight up against 9 other comedians.
What tips have you got?
How could I get an edge? And she said to me, well, probably the best way is, you know, what's it worth beyond just winning the competition? And I went, oh, I get you, right. So I told everybody that upstairs we had a meeting beforehand, you know, 9 of my, well, erstwhile friends. And I said, oh, can I just add that there's a whole lot of producers in from Channel 9 who are looking for new talent.
No.
So, you know, just do your best, guys. And 7 of them just lost their shit. So I came second.
Who won?
Danny Katz.
Danny Katz. Little white dove. Yeah, little white dove.
Canadian guy. And
well, he's a famous writer now. He's written many books.
Yeah.
He wrote the Little Lunch books, which have been turned into a show, a great show. And
yeah, and he's been giving advice in the Age for 20 years.
Yeah, he headlined the first gig I ever did.
Well, I said to him, how come you didn't get worried? And he said, I knew you were bullshitting.
Oh, really?
So anyway.
Oh, smart guy.
So there you go. Like, I won $50.
$50 coming second.
Rob Sitch was one of the...
one of the judges?
One of the judges.
Wow.
Yeah, it might have been Rob and Jane.
Jeez.
Mr. and Mrs. Oh.
A couple. Comedy royalty in Australia.
I know. And, you know, they helped launch, well, what ended up in Bright yesterday and today.
Yeah. They'd be so proud of us doing the Bright Football Club.
Well.
And that main bar.
I mean, they're good, but they probably couldn't do it.
No, you need experience to do what we've just done.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's many different ways to not scull beer out of someone's shoe.
Yeah.
You need to know them all.
Exactly.
Yeah, so anyway, that's that was my start. And then...
trying to remember where I first met you. I reckon I might have met you at La Joke, maybe even.
It's very, very likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you started a year after me, by then I would have been acting like I owned the joint.
Yeah, yeah, you did. I remember, yeah.
Yeah, until somebody who did actually own the joint would come along and then I...
Then you, no.
Oh, he's going a bit fast.
Oh, man, he's got a boat attached.
He's chased by a boat.
Good Lord. I didn't realise how far Bright was.
No.
You know, the last time I came to Bright was for Kate Lambrook's wedding. And I had no children back. In fact, my partner was pregnant, and so was Kate. So
it's 15 years ago.
15 years ago, yeah.
Wow.
My wife's like, you got to, before coming to Bright, she goes, you got to go to that bakery where we've got those swans. Remember we got those pastry swans? I'm like... I don't know if the Pastry Swan Bakery will still be in Bright.
Well, did you have a look?
I had a look. It's not there.
Did you have a mummy look?
I had a mummy look and I had a daddy look. I had a pretty good look.
Right. Because you like going to bakeries, don't you?
I love bakeries. I had a great sausage roll in Bright. A classic, old school country sausage roll. Not too big, not too small. Beautiful sausage roll.
You know, when we tour together, like we were in Perth and we've been to other places.
Yeah. We have. We've done a lot of gigs together.
And
in fact, I got this idea for this podcast by touring with you.
Well,
basically, because I'd be in the car with you and be talking, I'd think, this conversation deserves to be a podcast.
Yes. Well,
maybe not the one we're having now, but...
Yeah. This is where I got booked.
We got booked.
Yeah. Coming down this hill.
So just outside of your... Before Seymour, outside of your rower.
Back then, this is so long ago, but back then, it was a dual lane.
Yeah.
And we'd been stuck behind a caravan for about 30 clicks. And all of a sudden, it went into a two-lane section here.
Yeah.
And I was towing a trailer with two motorbikes on it. And I just pulled out and just passed everyone and ran over and in front of it. Here, cut this out. This is a really shit story.
No. We like it. We don't cut anything out on the debrief. It all goes in, mate. But I do love a bakery, yes.
We do love a bakery, and because Dave tends to go to bed a little bit earlier than I do.
I did last, and I went to my room and read.
Yeah, and and he tends to get up a bit early, and I always say, have breakfast with me, but what happens is, if I'm not up bright-eyed sharpish,
yeah,
Dave's the lure of the bakery takes over.
It's too much, because I'm not a big fan of breakfast. I'm not a breakfast person. And I don't know why. Maybe because I did breakfast radio for so long that I associate breakfast with work.
What do you like about bakeries, though?
I love a sausage roll, I love a cake, but I also love a chicken and salad roll. So, like in Perth, for example, I found this great bakery up the hill from where we were staying. It's in, I think it's called South Perth. And on the way to...
We're in North Perth.
We're in North Perth? Yeah, this was like... Oh, maybe it was North Perth.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That'd be a long walk to South Perth.
Yeah, it was. You're right, it was North Perth. And it was a great bakery. They had it going on. And it broke my heart the next day when I got up and walked there on a Saturday and it was closed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a walk.
I remember because you were quite short with me.
Yeah, yeah. You wanted to, I don't like breakfast buffets with, you know...
Yeah.
Muesli and...
But I think there's something a little bit more than that. I think that... I think there's an element of... You've come home if you go into a bakery. You walk in there and you you know, you take it all in, and to me, all I see is brown when I go to a bakery.
Yeah, it's a lot of beige in a bakery.
Brown, maybe a little bit of maroon. some teenage girl in a dirty sugar coated.
She's trying to earn some money.
I know.
There was a teenage girl in Bright, you're right.
Yeah, totally. But
can I help you with love? Can I help you with love?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what you're going for, isn't it? You're just going for the...
No.
You're going for the home style service.
I love it. But you know what? You know what? I haven't found a good bakery near my house, I have to say.
Really?
Well, I lived in the Western Suburbs for a long time. There was there were several good bakeries over there.
Vietnamese bakery?
No, I tend not to. There is a good one near me that does a great schnitzel roll, actually, and pork rolls. The famous Lee Bakery in Smith Street, Collingwood. There's one of those few places where you drive past and people are lining up during the day.
Yeah. Like Macca's back there.
Like Macca's in Euroa.
I saw a guy punching his entire family's order into the express order machine.
I thought,
mate, this is a false economy, honestly. You know, I would just walk up the counter and just go,
just order,
five
mate.
Happy Meals. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And I don't go to McDonald's very much. It's usually only with you or maybe another comedian on these trips. And how lazy are McDonald's getting? Like,
What do you mean?
Well, they want you to clean up after yourself.
Yeah.
And there were no napkins out or anything like that. And they were just like, they're going like one-armed paper hangers. There's an expression. You know, just belting out the orders. But then we're all standing around with bits of paper in our hand, waiting to have our order fulfilled.
You know,
that's not the McDonald's I remember.
No, and you know, the guy who came up with the idea of putting McDonald's in service stations is obviously some kind of genius.
Yeah.
Some kind of guy who just looked at service stations and went, we could do more than sell oil in these places.
Oh, well,
we're old enough to remember when service stations just didn't sell anything. They just sold oil and petrol.
And weird little rubber clips and...
And those things that hang from your windscreen, like a pine tree. And that was it. And now, they're full on...
But back then, somebody came and put petrol on your car.
Yes.
You didn't do it yourself. Unless, you know, your dad was one of those, I got this.
Yeah.
But I think that these McDonald's and the service stations probably help in breaking up the rigors of driving with your three kids in the back.
And that's why they have playgrounds too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A kid was shouting in there, kind of.
Oh man.
I wanted to go and shout into his whatever. He was in an egg or something. I mean, that just looked like lobster tanks for pedophiles.
Should have done that at the Bright Footy Club. I would have loved that.
I know. I forget to do it because it does shock people.
Funny that. All right. Hey, this episode of The Debrief is brought to you by Sheba. It's a great rideshare app where all the drivers are women. That's right. Every single driver is a woman. So set up your account by downloading the Apple or Android app, and multiple users can use the one account. Enjoy the one account. And also, this is a great idea for dads like myself. You can set up an account for your daughters. Corporate accounts are available too. Shiba also takes booking. It's female-only driving service. And Homie, they're a Melbourne-based social enterprise creating pathways out of homelessness. Do you know at the moment there's about 100,000 Australians live without a permanent address, and of those, 20,000 people sleep on the streets or in a makeshift shelter. Why not change this? Come on. Go to www.homie.com.au. Okay, back to the program. You're back on the debrief with Dave O'Neill and Brad Oakes. We're driving home from Bright, a mountain town where we've done two gigs. We've had a bit of a road trip, and we've certainly learned a lot about doing gigs in snow country that I may not return to ever. No, the footy club was fine. You're a bit of a scholar in comedy. You study comedy a bit, don't you, Brad? You've got a lot of opinions, and you help a lot of people out with their comedy.
Yeah.
You can do a bit of coaching. You've certainly helped me.
Yeah, I
directing. Yeah. You say it's sort of coaching directing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's more coaching. You know, it's just kind of like, coaches are useful in any performance discipline because you're watching from the outside. You can see what people are doing that they might not be able to see themselves.
Oh, yeah, it's handy, yeah.
And there's certain things, like certain principles, like that I'm full on about, which is that if you've been doing comedy, say, for as long as you have, if you write a joke and it doesn't quite work, given your instincts for writing jokes, then if there's a problem, it's probably not that the joke isn't funny. There's a problem in the communication of the joke.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
True.
Which is generally going to be a contextual problem, an assumption that people know something that you don't know, that you think they know, but they don't actually know it. That's, you know, that's one of the most common things.
Yeah, it's also trying to get across something that you think's funny in a way that other people find funny.
Yeah.
Basically.
And I suppose another aspect of that is that I think that you should get as many laughs as you can in whatever time you're allocated. So I think it's important not to say anything that doesn't need to be said.
Yeah. You're big in the cutting out of words, basically.
Yeah, but at the same time, just sounding, trying to make it sound natural. It's not, you don't want to be a robot.
No, not a robot. So you've been doing stand-up almost 30 years.
Yeah.
How has it changed, do you reckon, stand-up? Have you seen trends come and go, or...?
Look, I've seen trends. I've seen probably the first trend I ever really noticed was back in 94. I went to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Comedy Festival, and there was this real anti-political correctness movement at the Edinburgh Festival, sweeping British comedy. And I noticed in 1995 that all of a sudden it was sweeping the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I've seen trends such as that. Also, too, that I think that some people can't help but imitate. Well, not imitate, but you can see the influence.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and I think there may be a trend, say, people doing material that's far more kind of anecdotal as opposed to just jokes.
Sure. So more story. Yeah, that people talk about their own lives has certainly
increased. I see that a lot with new comedians.
And I
don't remember, like, I do remember, like, when most people start, their comedy is anecdotal because they're generally funny people who've been telling funny stories most of their lives.
Yeah, to their mates.
So the first stories they take on stage are those, you know, ones that they've
party stories, yeah.
Yeah. That they've handpicked from, you know, their own repertoire. But you can't rely on people finding, you know, growing up in Mitcham interesting.
Yeah, forever.
Forever.
And I know, I'm having a crack.
But I think that people, you know, hopefully people should be in a hurry to start writing jokes that are completely fabricated.
Yeah, right, you know, yeah.
You don't actually have to be going, hey, this is a slice of my life. Like, look, you know, I talk about, you know, I do that joke about growing up on a farm. You know, I say for the first 5 years of my life.
Yeah, you grew up on a farm, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know, I grew up in Hawthorne, you know. Yeah.
Very far from a farm.
I hate farms, right? And sometimes when people will come up to me and say, I grew up on a farm too, and we lost our farm in a flood like you did. Where was yours? And I go, oh, sorry.
Made that up.
I just completely made that up, you know.
But that's coming with being able to sell that joke. So you obviously sell it so people believe it.
Yeah, well, I look kind of stupid, so I look like I grew up on a farm.
Do you reckon you can pick talent? You can, because you've been around, you can see people and go, they're going to be big, or they're at least going to be successful one day? It's hard, I reckon.
Yeah. I think that, look, I think the only real sense of that is, because I think that you can only learn stand-up comedy by getting it wrong.
Yeah, by doing it. Yeah.
You do it, and you don't know what to do, so you do it. And if you do something wrong, it's pretty obvious that it's wrong. And you go, I'm not doing that again. But you don't know what you did right.
Yeah.
So I see that people who recover very quickly from making mistakes, you know, like people like Ronnie Chang.
Yeah.
You know, who... and Ronnie Chang's got a very, very hard-working, you know, work ethic. Anyway.
Combined with a sharp mind.
Yeah. But, you know, what they are is that they're people who go, okay, that didn't work. Why didn't that work? Don't do that again. Oh, this is working really well. And they can actually learn to identify what their strengths are. With those people, so you can't really watch them once. I saw Fiona O'Loughlin. She came to Melbourne.
On a bus.
Yeah.
I talked about that with her on this podcast, yeah.
Yeah, well, and you know,
you were the MC.
I was the MC, and I was running the night, and I said to her, you do want to jump up? And she said, I hadn't planned on. I said, well, you drive 36 hours on a bus to come to a comedy thing. Of course you have to get up. And I could see that she was very talented. You know. I could see Jim Owen was very talented, just because, you know, you're not just watching them; you're watching the audience watch them.
Yeah.
And you said the audience falling in love with them. You know, you go, oh well, there you go. You're strapped to the rocket.
I remember the first time I saw Ronnie Chang, because I'd met Ronnie so many times backstage, but because I'm in that position, especially 5 years ago when he started, I was headlining a lot, and also I had very young children, so I would turn up at the very last minute before I'd go on, you know what I mean?
Now you'd sit in your car and eat bakery goods.
But I'd met Ronnie backstage a lot, and he was so polite.
Yes.
You know, hi David, how's it going? He would always talk about my injuries because his sister's a doctor or a physio, and I thought, well, this guy is so polite. Then when I saw him on stage, it's a totally different... He's like he was the first angry Asian comic I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Which was just like, I was just blown away. The first thing I said to him when he came up, I said, have you got management? Because I think you're going to be pretty big. And he didn't have management then.
So. Yeah, but, you know, and see, I saw
him. So I offered to manage him, and...
I did a footy club gig with him, and he didn't have the best night.
No.
And the next time I did a footy club with him, you know, he'd rectified and corrected, you know, every
mistake he made.
And I mean, look at him now, you know, he just
well, he's on top of the world.
Yeah.
He's not driving home from Bright after doing the drop a duck day from a helicopter in the main bar of the
I hope he is. He'll be quite
he'll be jealous. He'd be wanting to be here. Mm. He'd swap the Daily Show for a footy club on a Sunday in Bright.
Oh, he's doing a national tour at the moment. He's in Hamer Hall.
You know? Probably.
You know, I'm in Jeff's shed.
We're in the Bright Footy Club, mate. So, because this is a debrief, I do have some debriefing questions for you.
Okay.
What Number one, what went well and why?
When?
You can cover both gigs if you want, or just...
Oh, okay. Either. Well, I think what went well in both of the gigs is that I started well.
Yeah.
And you started well, right?
Yeah.
And it is particularly... particularly in a gig like last night, a really, really hard gig, it's important that people know straight away that you know what you're doing. You know,
yeah, you have that confidence about you.
Yeah. Because, you know, like, you don't want to jump into an Uber and have some guy go, mate, look, this is my first night, can you tell me where the park brake is, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want to... So, that's my advice to all budding comedians, and even practicing comedians too, is... You don't walk out on stage and just chance it. What you do is you walk out on stage and you try and get it right. And that served us both very well.
Yeah. I was very timid for a long time doing stand-up, then I just went... No, I always had policy, take no prisoners and give 100%.
Yeah.
And just go for it. Because we had absolutely nothing to lose last night.
No, that was... Well, I thought we might lose our...
Actually, we could have.
Might lose our accommodation.
I love the way how we were about to start the comedy, all these bouncers appeared from nowhere, just sort of stood around the room. The manager had gone, could be trouble.
Yeah, and I said to one of the bouncers outside, I said, you look after us, and he said, we'll do what we can. I didn't tell you that, did I?
No.
We'll do what we can.
Now, what didn't go well and why?
Well...
Anything?
Yeah, the problem with comedy is, in my opinion, physically, comedy works best in a darkened room.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, where you can't see anything else but the comedian on stage.
Exactly.
That is your optimum. That is your best scenario.
Definitely.
With a good amplification, and people
focus. They focus.
Yeah, and people seated not plushly comfortable, but seated properly and so on.
Yeah, couches are no good.
Yeah. And in neither of those gigs did we have that.
No.
You know, like, we had a stage in Bright at the pub, but I just felt that was more like somewhere where we could stand so people could get a good shot throwing pots at us.
Yeah.
Right. And we didn't have a stage at the footy club. And as you pointed out, like, there was, like, six or seven tables, so there was about 100 people, mostly... young people and ladies.
Yeah.
That, you know,
sitting close to us where we were performing, yeah.
And then there was like a 10-foot gap, and then all these old blokes sitting up the back.
I know.
You know, like almost like some kind of harem.
Weird. As I said, I couldn't think of a more topical reference. I said, it looks like the cast of Cocoon sitting up. A reference from what must be 1980. Cocoon might have been.
Long time ago. See, whenever I always think of the swimming pool.
Oh yeah, right.
There was no pool, so I felt your reference was well, you know, you're talking about things that didn't work. That didn't work.
And with the, so what? Yeah, this leads on to the next question: what organisational problems or hazards got in the way? Oh, there were so many. We'd be here all day if we listed them.
Well, I asked the manager at the pub to turn off all the screens that were showing football.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'll turn up the one at the front, but close, people can watch it up the back if they want to. I asked him if he'd shut the pool tables. He said, no way. He did agree to turn the lights down.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we couldn't set our light up close enough for it to
be
have
really
its best
bright
effect.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And he did ask us to go back on after we'd finished.
Oh, But my point is, like, that people just assume that we bring it, that...
Oh, yeah, that we're like a band.
Yeah, and but that, you know, everything just falls into place. Like, I've turned up to gigs where they've said there was a sound system, and I've turned up, and what there is there's a karaoke microphone
with
a plastic lead that's 3 foot long, sticking out of the
the DJ box.
The DJ box.
Yeah, nightmare.
And you can't walk anywhere. And there's no tone, and you have to speak almost with a microphone in your mouth.
Yeah, not good.
And so people assume, and you know, and when we say, well, you know, I would like these conditions, they say, well, you can't have them. And you have to. So as I said to the guy, well, last night, the pub manager, I said, well, that's fine. I said, just brings down the guarantee of success a little bit.
Yeah, lower your expectations.
Yeah, because if you can't, you know, I mean, it's like rhythmic gymnastics, you know. If you're not going to give me a fluttery ribbon,
yeah,
I'm not going to bring the gold.
Exactly. We need that ribbon. So how can we do better next time? It's a final question.
Be famous.
Yeah.
And send our demands before us.
Yeah. Because, or say no.
Yeah. Well, you know, to an extent, I think sometimes you run into these comedians, like old comedians who, you know, travel around the countryside. They've got all their own kit, you know. And they, you know, they know. Like Ronnie Root or something like that.
Yeah.
They know they're going to set up the same way.
Every time.
You know, they've got their own sound system, guaranteed it's going to work. Whereas I think, you know, you borrowed yours
from pubs,
someone down
pub.
I thought it was someone down the docks, but all right, yeah. If you can't get consent to do that, to say, well, I want to set up this way, and, oh, can we move all the tables near the front? Well, you can move the tables. Well, you know, if I move all the tables before I do the gig, I don't look like a comedian.
No.
I look like the guy who moves the tables for the
comedian. Yeah.
It's not a bad idea, and you know, we're probably hopelessly remiss, and we talk about this over the years many times. It's a good idea to know what you're going into.
Yeah.
And we tend to maybe not do that enough.
Just turn up and wing it.
Yeah, because again, we've got good at, you know, flying jalopies.
Just coping with what's thrown at us.
Yeah.
Well, it's all been excellent stuff. Now, finally, we can play a song.
Yeah.
Any song on the debrief.
Yeah.
What should we play? We were playing a bit of On the Way Up.
Oils.
Midnight Oil.
Well, I think given that Brighton and Mountain Men,
yeah.
What about
Call
King
Me
of the Mountain?
Because you've got a... Tell us the Midnight Oil story. Come on, one more time.
Which one?
What about City on the Stack?
Oh, sitting on the speaker stack.
Yeah.
Back, yeah, you know, that was in the late 70s, I think. Sitting on the speaker stack and...
Where was this?
As said, the Sentimental Bloke.
Oh, yeah, I remember going
Bulleen.
There. And, I remember going there to see Moving Pictures. Oh.
And I'd climbed up. This was quite high. I was 12 foot off the ground or something like that.
Yeah.
And these bouncers and roadies came to get me down, and Peter Garrett goes, nah, leave him alone. He's not doing any harm to anyone. He's going to catch that Buster Bondi.
So you stayed up there?
So I stayed up there and...
Did you jump off into the crowd or...?
I stayed up there... I kind of had to stay up there after being allowed to.
By Pete, yeah.
Yeah, and then... But after a while, like, you know, I had, 3 gazillion decibels of music going in my ass. you know, things were starting to shake loose, you know. So I had to get
might down. Be out of the bathroom. Maybe bathroom break. Did you say to anyone, did you give me a hand down?
No, I jumped.
Oh, you jumped.
Yeah. They call me the king of the bathroom.
So where did you jump into the crowd or on stage?
Oh, I jumped onto, as I recall, I jumped onto some lower stacks.
Oh, God.
You know, that's how I got up there in the first place.
Yeah. It was a climb.
I had to levitate up there. I was a lot smaller back then, too. If anybody who's listening to this knows me, goes, Jesus Christ, how did you get Oaksy up there?
Yeah.
Without a hoist. Well, yeah. I was 18.
A long time ago.
I was 18.
Yeah, let's play the Oils. They're fantastic.
Okay. Cool. King of the Mountain.
King of the Mountain. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Brad.
And I've got a theory that that's about Peter Brock.
Yeah,
that's
you
just,
said that.
That's just me.
We don't know. We'll have to ask Pete when he comes on the podcast. I'm still waiting. Return the phone call.
Well, they're probably heading back from a very similar gig.
Yeah, probably. Brad Oakes, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you very much, Dave.